And now it's time for the Wild Side News with your host, Sydney Wildsmith.
As 2007 begins, so too the countdown to our future. 2006 was a year that acknowledged that life on Earth is changing and that we need to learn about the challenges and learn what to do. Today, we're inviting you to an event that can bring you some of the greatest stories of our wild and scenic heritage by the world's leading filmmakers. Take your seat. The show's about to begin. When your voice of the Earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Each new year is a time for looking back and looking forward. And it's no secret that 2006 was a year of change. Election 2006 sent a clear message that the environment matters, as the media was finally forced to begin reporting on the extraordinary reports of some of the hottest summers on record, of the changes in the oceans that lead scientists to predict that there just may be no fish left by 2050, and old energy policies that unleashed thousands of new oil and gas leases in what once was remote and inaccessible. In 2007, we'll see Americans refuse to see their front yards crisscrossed with pipes and wellheads. The media, but especially film, is playing a role in bringing these stories to the people, whether it be the chilling details of the lives of the emperor penguins in the Arctic, or the cold hard facts of global warming, as told by Al Gore in An Inconvenient Truth. And now, even animated films like Happy Feet bring important messaging about the impact that overfishing has on the animals we are learning to love as we come to know them through the wonders of dedicated videographers, storytellers, filmmakers, and brave new producers and directors who fight to get them shown. That's why I find it so important to invite all of you to participate one way or another in next weekend's Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival that's going to take over the historic mining town of Nevada City, California. We're going to be talking with Janet Cohen, the festival coordinator, during our first segment, then head to the mountaintop creative mecca of Lobitos Creek Ranch as we talk with a legendary player in documentary films, Steve Michelson, about his newest entrees to environmental filmmaking. Then in segment 3, environmental media is gaining momentum and Channel GTV is a kindling point of creativity in this emerging media sector. So it's an hour of film and filmmakers coming up. But first, the news. It was dramatic, at least that's what photos from a few years back indicate. A massive ice shelf the size of Manhattan Island broke free from its 3,000-year-old moorage as part of Ellesmere Island in the Canadian Arctic. Scientists studying satellite photos noticed a huge fissure between the ice bridge and the land, then noticed that within an hour, the massive 9-mile ice island had drifted a half mile off. Scientists generally agree that this is yet another indication of a universal warming trend and may presage future such events. Many were taken by the very sudden break and movement, having assumed such might occur much more slowly. Ice shelves in Canada's far north have decreased by 90% in the last 100 years. Within days of the break, the Ailes ice shelf had drifted 30 miles offshore, raising fears that as such events accelerate, shipping in such areas could become more hazardous. After years of obfuscation, denial, qualifiers, and cautious rhetoric, the U.S. government, through its Department of the Interior, has officially acknowledged that global warming is changing the future of planet Earth, as Interior Secretary Dirk Kempthorne proposed listing polar bears as a threatened species. Kempthorne stated that the decision was based at least partially on the concern that polar bears' habitat may literally be melting. When unspun, the words are translated as, "Global warming is melting the ice." Polar bear populations are declining as overhunting and loss of habitat take their toll. The listing may ultimately lead to regulatory control of factors which contribute to the decline, which of course could include CO2 emissions, the giant invisible monster being blamed for much of our planet's declining diversity, as rising temperatures bring about radical shifts in habitats, seasons, and the populations that have developed over millions of years to live in balance with their natural homes. Some declining animal populations have no apparent explanation at all. Dozens of endangered great one-horned rhinoceros have mysteriously vanished from a nature reserve where they have been introduced in areas around Kathmandu, Nepal. Of the 72 rhinos brought in, 23 were recorded as dead by poaching, and the rest, well, no one really knows what happened. Poachers generally leave the body of the animal, which is killed solely for its single horn, which is worth many thousands of dollars, in the illegal trade in endangered animal parts. The one-horned species has been one of the great success stories, as strict protection, especially in India, brought their total numbers from around 100 a century ago to over 2,500 in recent years. And in another part of the world, China is proposing to lift a 13-year domestic ban on the tiger part trade and institute sale of farm-raised tiger parts to meet the demand by traditional medicine, which uses bones, organs, claws, fat, and blood in a variety of curative admixtures. China claims the addition of farm-raised parts would lessen the strain on wild tigers by meeting these demands. Conservationists, on the other hand, fear that encouraging such trade will in fact increase demand and therefore certainly bring about the demise of the already threatened species. A leading advocate of Chinese tiger farms believes that up to a population of over 100,000 tigers on farms could provide up to 10,000 carcasses from natural deaths per year within the next 15 years. It is, in fact, a controversy that is likely to continue for years to come, as no demonstrable definitive answer has been agreed to. And, following the trends, Australian Prime Minister John Howard predicts that Australia will be aggressively expanding their nuclear industry in the years ahead in order to meet increasing energy demands and to use the vast uranium reserves native to Australia in an effort to decrease their greenhouse gas emissions. With current projections, Australia could have 25 new nuclear power plants online by 2050, producing a third of their energy needs and decreasing their greenhouse gases by up to 17%. The future is still living with a nuclear cloud hanging before us, and decisions such as this will increase rather than decrease as economic, cultural, and environmental values meet in the battlefield of competing strategic wills. And that's the news. So now we turn our attention to the exciting world of films and filmmakers who are spanning the globe to tell the stories of challenge and of victory in our efforts to save the wild and the scenic for ourselves and the generations to come. Well, here it is, 2007, and hopefully this is going to be a terrific year, because last year had some problems in so many different ways. Certain realities began to really hit us upside the head in terms of the future of this planet, whether it be global warming or troubles in the seas and the oceans, troubles with species disappearing, polar bears and others. And what's happened, though, with that has come actually some media awareness, and the message is beginning to achieve some level of critical awareness that things must change. Nothing works better in bringing that message forward than media, and in particular film and video. In just about a week or so, up in Nevada City, California, there's going to be the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival, which is bringing together some of the best media available. And to help us really understand that is the film festival coordinator, Janet Cohen. Janet, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Janet, this is your fifth annual film festival. Why don't you give us a little history on this and how it's growing, and then we'll get into some of the details about what's happening.
Thanks very much. Yeah, we started 5 years ago, and it is a originally a fundraiser, and still is, for the South Yuba River Citizens League, which is a grassroots watershed-based organization up in Northern California. The goal of the organization is to protect and preserve the South, well, the Yuba River and its watershed, a very, very gorgeous and well-kept secret river of Nevada, of Northern California. And we thought it would be a good idea to see whether an environmental film festival would be a popular fundraiser. And I think the first year we had about 25 movies, and we showed on two screens for about a day and one evening. And we were extremely worried whether or not anybody would actually turn up. We discouraged filmmakers from coming because we weren't sure whether anyone was going to actually come and watch the movies. And it was a standing room only event. We had to put on an extra special nighttime session to accommodate all the people who couldn't get in. And basically, we've doubled in size every year since then. Until now, we believe that we're probably the largest environmental film festival in America.
Wow, that's sensational. Well, what does that mean? How many films are going to be screened?
We're showing around 110 movies. There are about 40 premieres of one sort or another, from world premieres to West Coast and California premieres. We have about 80 speakers coming, filmmakers and activists. And we basically take over the town. It's one of those wonderful towns that lends itself to a film festival, you know, sort of like Park City and Telluride. It's a little gold rush town nestled in the foothills of the Sierra Mountains. And essentially, we show movies in five different venues. We have parties going on throughout the town, free opening receptions. We have a wine stroll. Every lunchtime, all the cafes are taken over with chats with the filmmaker sessions, where you can meet the filmmaker and talk more about the issues in their movies. We've got an activist center going on in City Hall where people will be talking about issues raised in the movies. And we've got art shows going on in 14 different places. I mean, we really intended to take over the town, and we really do.
For people who want to start thinking about showing up, what's the date?
It runs from Friday, January the 12th to Sunday, January the 14th. And they can go online to www.wildandscenicfilmfestival.org. And the schedule's up there, all the downtown events, all the ticket information, everything they need to know is there.
I've talked with some of the people who will be presenting their films, some of the videographers and producer and executive directors. It's an extraordinary event. Some of the best will be there. Let's go ahead and start talking about some of the highlights of the event.
It's always an interesting event because we never know what we're going to be sent and what films are out there. And for instance, last year, the theme running through it was clearly a Native American theme. We had lots and lots of movies about interesting aspects of Native American life and history. This year, there's no common theme. It's really interesting because we have some tremendously wonderful movies, extremely important movies about all sorts of subjects. And when we sat back and thought about them all, we all of a sudden realized that really what was coming through was ordinary people doing extraordinary things, people who were working to save their part of the planet and the place that they loved and the people that they loved and being extremely heroic about it. People like you and me who really put themselves on the front lines. And we're featuring, you know, almost as a centerpiece throughout the festival, these shorts about the Goldman Prize Award winners who are heroes from around the world. I don't know whether your listeners know about the Goldman Award.
Well, why don't you go ahead and give that background, because that is one of the most prestigious environmental awards given out to people, the doers on the planet.
Yeah, the Goldman Awards, you can Google Goldman Award and find out about it. It's the Nobel Prize, really, of the environmental movement. The Goldman Foundation gives out six awards of, I think, $125,000 a year to people from around the world. I mean, people who $125,000 will entirely alter the way they live and work to an amazing degree. People from Liberia who, you know, in incredibly difficult circumstances, risking life and limb to save the hardwood forests and really to bring down a dictatorship. People in Haiti, a man in Haiti who's apparently, I mean, I hadn't realized before I saw this little five-minute movie about this guy. Haiti only has 2% tree cover left.
That's right.
Unbelievable. And he's out there with this mass movement replanting Haiti, again, being threatened with death on a very regular basis. So there are people from everywhere, all around the world, doing extraordinary things, and we're showing films on all of them, all of the last 3 years' recipients. And there are another wonderful movie is about two, you know, ordinary I don't like to use the word ordinary, but people like you and me, environmental activists, who are working volunteers for Greenpeace in England, and they were sued by McDonald's for libel, and then went into this enormous 15-year lawsuit that I don't really want to say what happened in the end because it will give the game away. But again, heroic people who stood up where nobody else was standing up and saying no to McDonald's. We won't count out to you. You know, unlikely heroes, two men in Australia, you know, one with a beard down to his knees, you know, a biologist who lives in the outback of Australia, and another man, a park ranger, who decided that they were going to save this little marsupial, the bilby, from extinction. And they did. An extraordinary story.
You make such an interesting point that you never know what's coming in, and I'd just be curious about your perspective in terms of, you've been doing this now for 5 years. What's the trend? What's happening? I mean, there's many different ways of looking at nature. One would be from the perspective of just nature itself and its glories and wonders and beauty and grandeur. Then, of course, you have people talking about protecting nature and different things that are happening. And then you have those people who are, as you say, laying their lives on the line. Mm-hmm. Sea Shepherd, for example, Paul Watson and others.
Right.
What's the trend? And also, what's happening in terms of the storyline? I'm just really curious about that. Obviously, people who want to see that can come to the festival. What are you noticing?
Well, first of all, it seems to me that there are just more movies being made about environmental issues, which is great. You know, at the most obvious level, Al Gore's movie, The Inconvenient Truth. I mean, I saw it on United Airlines flight the other day coming across the Atlantic. There's just much more interest in making and seeing these sorts of movies about issues relating to the world in which we live. In terms of how filmmakers go about really portraying their feelings about this, it varies. It's across the board. I mean, we could, if we wanted to, and we don't want to, show an entire weekend of incredibly depressing movies, which would, you know, and make everybody go out and slit their wrists at the end of the weekend.
Right.
Because there are some extremely depressing facts. Mm-hmm. We cannot get away from them. We think we're seeing more movies, or it may be our bias in what we want to show. What we try to show is people doing something about it, because there really isn't very much point in showing just movies about how dreadful things are. And we'd like to show a mix. I mean, we cannot avoid the fact that things are bad. You know, species are going extinct, you know, waste is being dumped, you know, children are being affected, you know, all our lives are being affected. But there seems to be a trend towards making movies showing people doing things about it.
The death and destruction seems to be what I'd call a 1970s environmental film message. But what I think has happened is that people have just become so absolutely frustrated because these stories of what can be done and the fact that we can unite and we can work together and make a difference, unfortunately, is never presented in an effective way in the mainstream media. So people are just plain doing it themselves.
Yeah, and that's so wonderful. I mean, the other thing about film festivals in general is that, you know, certainly ours, you know, many of these filmmakers can't get their films shown anywhere. You know, they're independent filmmakers, and a film festival of this sort is their only venue. And people lap it up. I mean, honestly, we were shocked that the very first film festival where we tried to discourage the filmmakers from coming, a few of them insisted on coming. And we just all of a sudden realized that the audience couldn't get enough of speaking to real experts on the issues. So we've really expanded that. You know, we invite everybody we can.
And quite honestly, a lot of grassroots activists, people who just really care and really want to do something, one of the ways in which activism is expanding out now is through the media.
Oh, yeah.
And house parties and private showings and even presenting this type of media to your local PBS station or
Absolutely.
Whatever else. So this is a place where you can go in on a weekend, really get a sense of what's available, the best that's out there, because nothing works better right now. The media is the message, and that's what we have to do. What a great opportunity for people to just plain spend a weekend and know what's going on.
And it's a wonderful place to meet. I mean, everything is within walking distance, so people are, you know, bumping into each other in the street and saying, what did you just see? Oh, you missed that one. That was so great. Go and see it when it's on tomorrow. And, you should hear the conversations. People are so jazzed about what they're seeing.
So people do show up in Nevada City on Friday. And then are there multiple showings of individual films, or is it pretty well tightly scheduled? Because you have so many different presentations. How should people plan?
They need to plan very carefully. This is one of those things where you can't see everything. We're showing 110 movies, but there's no, you simply can't see them unless you cloned yourself. So you have to, you know, people come with, as soon as the program comes out, people are there with highlighters saying, you know, and trying to pick our brains about which are the best movies and so forth. And what I would say is that we have a subject category list at the end of the program. So you can, if you're particularly interested in one, you know, like forestry or something like that, you can actually plan your weekend around those films. Or if you want to see award winners from other film festivals, we've got all the awards listed after each film. And films that have gotten awards are, it's usually indicative that they are very good. And then, of course, there are the premieres. You know, if you want to be the first one to see a particular film, that's also another way of going about it. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, again, word of mouth throughout the film festival spreads. And we can't repeat many films, which is sometimes a complaint. But you know, there are just so many good films. We can't repeat too often. We're on a limited time scale here.
Well, that's just the way life is. There's no way around that. Yeah.
Yeah, and the film festival is really put on by a very small skeleton staff of paid people. We have 200 volunteers who put the thing on for real. You know, our tech crew down to bartenders. Everybody is unpaid, and there's a limit to how far we can push our volunteers and how many days we can ask them to work.
Let's talk about films start at what time and how late do they go into the evening?
On Friday, actually, the first thing that's happening is three parties in downtown galleries, and they're free parties just to opening receptions from 4:30 to 6:30. And then from the film start themselves, doors open at 6, and films start in five different screens at 7.
Mm.
And there's music from people like Tuck and Patty, who a lot of people in Northern California will know. People can hear them playing before the film's on Friday night from 6 to 7. And they go till about 10. And, you know, it varies slightly. And then the next day, again, 9:30 all the way through with a few breaks till 10. And then on Sunday, again, it starts at 10, actually. And then we stop for an awards ceremony, and then all the award-winning movies are being shown at all four of the venues in the afternoon.
There's also, besides the films, you're going to have the opportunity to meet and talk with the producers, the directors, the screenwriters, et cetera, et cetera. So it's an extraordinary opportunity to learn more and meet on a personal level those people whose passion it is to create these.
Yeah. And a lot of people who are in the movie, people who are featured in those movies, you know, are there too. So before or after a vast majority of the movies, we have we have them up on stage and brief chats. But then on lunchtimes, both on Saturday and Sunday, we basically give everybody lunch to go out and talk to the audience. So all the cafes locally are full of people talking about films.
Well, now, one practical thing for people who want to show up, how about accommodations?
The best way right now is to go to the Nevada City Chamber of Commerce site or to phone us up at 5. I think that we have a link on our website to the Chamber of Commerce site, and there are motels all over the place which are filling up fast.
And then also for people who want to literally find out about the schedule?
Yeah, it's www.wildandscenicfilmfestival.org. And the schedule, right on the homepage, you'll see a link to the schedule and links to how to buy tickets.
And, of course, there is a fee.
Tickets actually range from $5. We have a wonderful kids' environmental sort of cartoon and documentary showing every year. We've had this great popcorn crowd on Saturday mornings. And for that, you can take your kids for just $5. But tickets range all the way up to $220. Probably the best deal is the $82 Wild and Scenic Weekend Pass, which gets you into every venue.
Oh, that's a bargain.
Oh, it's totally a bargain.
I was beginning to think, you know, like, oh boy, I have to take out a loan on my house here, $1,200 or something like that, because some of these film festivals cost you a fortune. That's a bargain.
Oh, yeah. I mean, we're trying to get people to watch these movies. We're trying to make it, you know, available to people. And it is an expensive event to put on, so we can't make it, you know, $10 for the weekend, but it's a deal. Yeah, when you look at other film festival prices, this is a major deal.
Now, you've partnered with some major people who've helped you out with this. Why don't you tell us about who's participating in putting on this event?
We've teamed up with a major sponsor. Our title sponsor is Patagonia, the outdoor clothing company, who are truly wonderful people and have a fantastic environmental foundation of their own. And they teamed up with us to put on this home festival, this big festival. And also, when we take the film festival on tour, which we do, we take it throughout the country to activist organizations all over America. And Patagonia has partnered with that, too. The other major sponsor, we have a few other major sponsors, a couple of foundations, and also Environmental Defense, who, if anyone knows what's going on out there in the world of environmentalism these days, Environmental Defense is a leader. Mm-hmm. And so they'll be there in force, too.
Well, definitely talk about the tour, because that's the way this can reach out. If you can't attend the festival can come to you.
Yeah, absolutely. The tour really started a few years ago when people were phoning us up from all over the place saying, how do we put on an environmental film festival? And I basically said, no, we're going to do it for them. And we essentially provide a list of films that they can choose from, and then an entire package on how to put an event on. Essentially, it's a film festival event, but it would... We really wanted to enable small groups to be able to put on events for the rest of their existence. So it comes with a whole package on how to promote an event and how to, you know, write a press release and all that sort of stuff. Because, you know, my theory is you could have the Rolling Stones coming to town, and if you didn't tell anyone about it, no one would come. So, you know, it's terribly important to teach people how to promote and publicize the film festival and any event they put on. So we've probably shown this last year to about 30 places, and next year is going to go up to 50 places. And really, again, they would see something on the website about the tour and how to contact us about that.
One of the great things that's happening now is the media is really expanding out into the public such that regular folks now can pick up a digital camera,
yep,
a video camera, and get out there and make a difference.
Or they can even do that on their cell phone these days.
That's exactly right.
Yep.
You know, if you're witnessing something or participating someplace, or wherever you are, you can actually capture stuff. And then the other side of that as well, and I would guess that this is going to be available, and that is that people can actually buy these DVDs,
yes,
and take them home with them.
Yeah, absolutely. We encourage filmmakers to send us, you know, 10, 20 of their DVDs, and we have a whole booth set up to sell them.
Well, why don't you go ahead and give us a summary on the event, where it's happening, when?
It's January the 12th to the 14th. In a couple of weeks' time in Nevada City, California, which is beautiful Northern California, and ticket prices range from $5 to $220. You can buy a weekend pass for a mere $82. And for that, you'll get 110 movies, about 40 premieres, 80 speakers, a wine stroll, VIP parties, opening receptions, art galleries, and loads more.
Sounds like an absolute must. If you can possibly make it, show up. This is the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival, the fifth annual. It's happening in Nevada City. We've been talking with Janet Cohen, who is the film festival coordinator. Janet, thanks so much, and have a great and successful weekend.
Well, thanks so much for having us, and we look forward to having some of your listeners come.
Sounds great. Thanks.
Thanks.
It's a lot of creative energy that goes into making films. And a studio on a hill is helping to clear the vision of our past and our future through some highly collaborative work by some very dedicated people. We're heading up to the mountaintop Mecca with Steve Michelson, executive director of the Lobitos Creek Ranch Studio, and learn about Steve's renewed dedication to films of earth and wonder. When your voice of the earth continues, here on the Wild Side News.
Melting polar ice was a dirty look. Shrinking glaciers, a nudge. Then dying coral reefs pushed us, hard. Rising ocean temperatures and extreme weather, an uppercut. Then record-breaking heat waves hit us right where it hurts. Has it occurred to anyone that maybe the Earth is trying to get our attention?
We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. To find out how, go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wild Side News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
So here's the word on the street. Nature is hot. Get into doing movies, documentaries, animated films about the Earth and animals. They're showing Al Gore's Inconvenient Truth on airlines these days. And in the industry, you have to give people what they want. And what they want right now is a real-world vision of hope, health, and wonder. Global warming isn't just about weather, because global media is heating up. You'll see. Just stay tuned. It seems as if nature and the environment is increasing in popularity as a medium around the world. And nothing can speak more to that than the upcoming 5th Annual 2007 Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival that's happening in Nevada City, California. It's an extraordinary collection of filmmakers and videographers and people involved in nature and environmental media. And joining us now from Half Moon Bay in California, outside of San Francisco, is Stephen Michelson, who is the executive producer of Lobitos Creek Ranch, which is a production facility that really focuses on many different media. But he's going to be showing and discussing some of his work at the festival. Steve, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you.
You've been involved in film and production for a very long time, 30 years and more, and now you have your own studio. First of all, talk about Lobitos Creek Ranch. It sounds fascinating.
Yeah, I'm actually from a four-generation media family. My father was one of the country's first radio producers and sound recordists, and he represented Walt Disney and handled international distribution, was one of the pioneers in that whole area. So I grew up in the media. My grandfather even was involved there, even before him, distributing the RCA phonograph discs when they first came out. So media was pretty much in the blood as a child and never really had any thoughts of doing anything other than that. Although I never really was interested in distribution, I was much more interested in the fun stuff as a kid. We would go out and record sound effects. Our family created what is the center of the CBS sound effects library. It was the world's largest sound effects library in its day in the 60s. So I moved here to San Francisco and started a company called OnePass, and it just in the early, mid-70s, and it became one of the country's largest post-production companies, expanded to New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Boston, and really was way more than I ever thought I had ever intended on doing. It was like a tiger that I had by the tail that I couldn't let go of. And I sold that company to a publishing company, printing company, in the late 80s and started making my own films and building my own studio here at Lobitos Creek Ranch, which is a 70-acre, people call it Skywalker, for people who don't have budgets of $40 million or more. And it's a wonderful place for creative projects. We specialize in documentaries and special interest programming.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly, that's what we like to do. That's what San Francisco Bay Area is extremely well known for, and there's a tremendous amount of talent here.
That's true. It's a progressive area, and as you say, there's great stories that come from there that you perhaps don't come from other places. Something about the soul of San Francisco, perhaps it's the environment in which you all live.
I'm so glad you mentioned that, Sydney, because most people don't know that San Francisco has the country's largest enclave of documentary filmmakers, at least people who say there that that's what they do for a living. Sometimes it may take 5 or 6 years to make a film. And those are the kinds of films that we are most interested in because it shows a level of passion and commitment on the filmmaker's side that you rarely see from Hollywood.
You've been involved in documentary films. Give us a sense of some of the arenas that you've explored.
You know, documentaries tend to take on topics that are just not handled in our traditional media. Just at the Wild and Scenic Festival alone, we have three projects which we'll be showcasing there. The series that we have produced ourselves called Forever Wild is a series on wilderness and the history of wilderness in America, something which we feel is really going to start to gain traction with the Democratic Congress now. Also, a wonderful film by filmmaker Jay Wood called Crude Impact is a documentary story about peak oil and the history of oil in our economy, in our nation, and all over the world. The impact of oil hasn't really been put together quite like this to see how all these aspects of population, food production, and all the other environmental aspects of oil on native peoples in South America and Africa. It's all kind of there in one 90-minute showing. You now know everything you need to know to take action. It won the Best Environmental Film at the Artivist Film Festival in Los Angeles about a month ago. So, you know, it's being noticed quite extensively.
And your third one is?
The third project we've been involved with more on our DVD authoring and toolkit sides, one of the areas we specialize in, which we'll talk about in a minute, I expect, because we'll be giving a whole workshop at the Wild and Scenic Festival about toolkits and sort of what happens besides just watching the documentary. How do you involve people?
That'll be a great resource for people interested in expanding out this media, which is so critical right now.
Yes, and so the third film is called Discover Hetch Hetchy by filmmaker David Vassar, and it includes one of our toolkits that's being promoted by the Environmental Defense Fund, which is one of the sponsors, the sponsor of the film. Harrison Ford is involved, and it's an effort to remove the Hetch Hetchy Dam and restore Hetch Hetchy as a national park, a sister park with Yosemite. So it's a marvelous environmental project. It has an amazing story behind it, and it's quite an interesting proposition.
Let's start, first of all, with your Forever Wild series. It has kind of an interesting history and is actually a series of different episodes. Talk about Forever Wild, how it started, what kind of happened to it, and why it's coming back now.
Well, Forever Wild was originally developed by U.S. News and World Report, whom we are now partners with in the creation of U.S. News Productions, which is an amazing new development for us. U.S. News, for those who don't know it, is the 12th largest publisher in the United States. They have 11 million readers. They have one of the most active websites in the country. Over 30 million unique users visit that website. And so they were the ones who initially commissioned this project, and we sold it originally to the Disney Channel. It was going to compete with National Geographic Explorer as family viewing. There are 6 episodes planned of 6 of our best national parks: Yellowstone, Yosemite, the Grand Canyon, the Everglades, which most people don't know that story, the Adirondacks, which were actually one of the very first places where wilderness came to be in America, and also the Cape Cod National Seashore. And we recruited Roderick Nash, a legend in environmental history. He wrote the book. It's the best-selling book of by Yale University Press, called Wilderness and the American Mind. It's the Bible of the environmental history subject in this country. And he's the host of the films, all of them, tying them all together.
He's a grand historian. I've actually interviewed him on the show.
Oh, wonderful. Mm-hmm. Yes, he is quite an amazing guy. And we brought together people like David Brower, who will be shown in the Yosemite episode at Wild and Scenic, and Martin Litton, who's still living and is an environmental legend, who, along with Brower, pretty much saved the Grand Canyon from becoming a series of lakes, and quite a few others. And you learn the history of these heroes who literally saved these precious places and created what we now know as our national parks, and the story of how America discovered this along with these explorations is an amazing story of pride and for the country, and kind of combined art and photography, and it's the kind of thing that, you know, we just don't seem to do very much anymore of.
Well, and of course, the legacy of wilderness is truly embedded in the history of America in terms of our ethos and our own identity. And the creation of national parks has such a role in defining who we are, and so I really can appreciate your effort here. Are these half-hour series?
They're all 1 hours.
Wow.
So it's 6 one-hour episodes.
And so you interweave, what, historic film and interviews as well with video interpretations of the parks themselves?
Well, Ted Danson is the narrator of this. Ted Danson, most people also don't know. He's a well-known Hollywood actor, but he's also the founder and very committed environmentalist of originally called the American Oceans Campaign, and now has a new name. And he is a terrific narrator who kind of spins the whole story. And we do interview a number of people, but the hero of these films are the parks themselves. They're all shot in beautiful 35mm time-lapse photography, and mostly all of it was shot on film. We do have historical footage. When you learn about the history of our government and development. It's quite a, you know, Marion Stone Douglas, who was the woman who put the Everglades on the map, you know, she fought a courageous battle, and she was recognized by President Clinton in the 90s for her work. So you really learn this history of what it took to create a national park.
Mm-hmm. At the film festival itself, you're going to be focusing on the Yosemite episode, and which is one of six. Yosemite, of course, was one of the cornerstones of the national park system. When will this be showing at the film festival?
It's going to be in the Great Hall on Saturday the 13th. I think it's 8 o'clock at the Great Hall. And really looking forward to that, and hopefully a lot of people will show up to enjoy it.
Just in terms of the future of Forever Wild, where is this? What are the venues where this will be showing in the future?
It's going to be playing around film festivals, different film festivals around the country for the next year and a half, and then we're expecting to place the entire series on public television. We have quite a number of underwriters lining up to help present it, many of whom are connected with U.S. News and World Report. We have brought the Sierra Club into quite a few of our projects, and so they are helping us to distribute these films as well.
Mm-hmm.
And we also expect that it will be on Link TV as a special program that kicks off their programming this spring. Well, one of the unique things about it is that we're planning on, with the DVD set that will be available, providing people with the opportunity, if they buy the whole set, where they'll get an Eagle Pass so they can actually, for free.
Great, so, that's fabulous. Which is a pass to the national park system.
Exactly, it lasts for the whole year. So as you, you know, all of our projects, Sydney, are more than just films. We try to create campaigns and what we call event programming. Because, you know, making a film these days can be a disappointing process. It's really, if you're going to make a film, you might as well do all the rest of the things that are necessary to really get the word and get that whole experience out there.
Now, of course, another one of the films that you're really featuring is Crude Impact, which is so timely right now.
Yes.
And it's a story that needs to be told and also to create a vision of what our future, what we're really facing, and it's a problem that many people aren't really willing to take a serious look at. Sounds like you've done something here that's important.
Yes, Crude Impact is an extraordinary film by producer-director Jay Wood. It's Jay's first film. He was a high-tech guy and more or less came to filmmaking through a passion and a trip he took to South America with a group called Pachamama Alliance. And on that trip, he really saw the devastation that was being spread by, you know, the world's oil companies, and decided to do something about it. And he had the means to do so, and he read every book on the subject. He's really a, you know, someone who does his research and his homework, and he put together some amazing facts and information all in one place. One of the premier books is called The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight by Tom Hartman, who's featured in the film. People like Amy Goodman and a number of other authors, are Richard Heinberg, are in this film. So you get the sense of what everyone is concerned about, and you see all the way back when originally peak oil was projected in the United States in the early 70s, and now it's being projected for the rest of the world, which is, it's 2007, is the year when the world's oil supply is going to be diminishing from here on out. So you witness the devastation that's been extracted on native peoples where oil has been discovered, and you come away, our tagline for the film is, it's worse than you think, but it's not too late. We do have an optimistic view on what can be done and how things can be turned around, but it doesn't happen by being a couch potato, that's for sure. People have to initiate an awful lot of change in order for us to, you know, move forward from this dilemma. And we are, as a project, going to be initiating a campaign and providing a toolkit for people on our website, crudeimpact.com, and also through the Sierra Club and a number of other affiliate and alliances that we're creating.
Do you know when that's going to be showing?
That will be on Friday night. And at the Nevada Theater at also, I think, 8 o'clock.
Mm-hmm. Now, is the focus, by the way, of Crude Impact primarily from the perspective of South America? Because that's interesting. We don't usually think of oil and its impact in South America. That's not something that's on our radar screen as Americans.
Well, you know, there's quite a lot of oil that's come out of the Ecuadorian rainforests, and so there's quite a impassioned story there. But there's an equally powerful story about Ken Sarawiwa, who was the legendary Ohlone tribe member who led the fight against shale oil in Nigeria.
Mm-hmm.
And so that is another example of how oil has impacted some of these continents. It's where we get the oil and what we've done to the places where the oil has come from.
You know, you're the executive producer of this, which means you have to go out and get the money. And when it comes to a film like this, I'm just curious, how do you find sources? You know, the oil industries and the industry is so well-funded. Where do you find the funding for a film like this?
Well, it's a very good question, and that's the question that always seems to come up. In this particular case, the film was self-funded by the filmmaker for the large part, but pretty much we're now looking for funds for the outreach and for the distribution and the marketing and the whole process that I was just describing of creating an event around it. We're going to be in 150 venues with the Sierra Club's Energy Tour.
That's a great idea.
Energy Film Festival. So we'll get the word out that way. We're going to be raising money from sponsors and underwriters, corporations, nonprofits, individual philanthropists. People literally make contributions to these kinds of projects. School kids make contributions to these projects because they're so concerned about what they learn from them and want us to help spread the word. It's really what our toolkits are all about, Sydney. We have a view here at Libidos Creek Ranch that you have to create what's now being called the engaged viewer. Everyone's searching for who is and what is the engaged viewer, and so our definition of that is you've got to entertain people with an award-winning film. That's never going away. But once you've done that, you have to engage them with other information, mostly internet-based, web-based, and DVD-ROM-based information that we have residing on the DVD with the film. And along with that, you have to give them the third part of this technique, which is the ability to act. And they may act by contacting their congressman. We give them a website where they can even find out who their congressman is. We give them letters that are already pre-written. We make it very easy and convenient for people to do things if they're motivated to. And what we're finding is that the results from our projects is extraordinary.
So if I have this correct, what you're saying, because I know that you love the concept of DVDs, and so do I. What a powerful, powerful tool. The toolkit really is in the form of a DVD?
It's on the DVD-ROM sector of the DVD.
Right.
There are three types of DVDs. Mm-hmm. Most people are familiar with one type, which is called a title. But the other two types, there's a template and a toolkit,
mm-hmm.
and we specialize in both of those two. But the toolkits especially provide a very rich place where you can store an enormous amount of content and web links and information. We put posters, for instance, that are made in Microsoft Word so people can customize the posters. And we encourage people to have screenings of these films, house parties, and we give them all the tools that are necessary. You know, if someone asks themselves after seeing a movie like this, well, what can I do? Everyone asks that question, and most of the time it goes unanswered. But we don't allow that to happen. We say, well, if you like this film, then show it to your friends and family and invite people to your home. We give them all the tools for discussion guides, for posters that they can put up at their school or church. So we're talking about getting people to be activists and do things.
I love that concept. That is so revolutionary in terms of, because, you know, distribution and how do you get all this information and where do you go to get it, it's all really contained on that DVD. It's sort of like getting a DVD and looking at the bonus features on the on a movie DVD.
We have the bonus features, mm-hmm. but we also have all the rest of the information that you'd ever possibly want to know. You could spend 8 or 10 hours on some of our DVDs, you know, just exploring the information that we provide.
It's a real model. That's why you're trying to really help people understand how this works.
Yes. The benchmark, which premiered at Wild and Scenic a few years ago, a film we co-produced called Oil on Ice, about the Arctic National Wildlife mm-hmm. Refuge and the fight up there to preserve it as wilderness or to drill, really set the tone for that whole toolkit approach.
Well, Steve, I wish we had a lot more time to talk about all of this, particularly the toolkit. Maybe we'll have a chance to go in depth on some of that in the future here. But unfortunately, we're out of time. We're talking with Steve Michelson, who is the executive producer of many different things, including some movies that will be featured at the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival, including Forever Wild series, which is a personal love affair that he has produced. But as well, he's the executive producer of Crude Impact, and you're putting on this workshop with a toolkit. When is that happening?
That happens on Saturday, and it's about midday.
Now, Steve, if people want to find out more about your work and your studio, tell them how to get there.
You can get in touch with us through our website, which is www.lobitos, L-O-B-I-T-O-S, creekranch.com.
Steve, thanks so much for adding your voice. The wonders of science and technology are providing us the tools to bring the world's wonders to life through film, video, streaming media, and now its own TV station. Channel G TV is coming up. Don't change that channel.
I'm getting a catcher's mitt.
I'm getting ice skates.
I'm getting a jigsaw puzzle.
I'm getting dying coral reefs.
A blue bicycle.
A walkie-talkie.
I'm getting a severe drought.
Cool black skateboard.
I'm getting melted ice caps.
A killer heat wave.
A shrinking glacier.
I'm getting a devastating flood.
Adults are generous. We're even giving kids global warming. But it's not too late. We can still reduce greenhouse gas pollution. Go to fightglobalwarming.com. Brought to you by Environmental Defense, the Robertson Foundation, and the Ad Council.
Welcome back to the Wildside News. And now, Sydney Wildsmith.
Wouldn't it be nice to be able to spend an evening learning about things that really matter? It's such a huge world, and there's so much going on. Some of it good, some of it not so good. But there's something about getting the truth that gives us all a sense that we do indeed have hope for helping to restore and make better this wonder of life and diversity that is our home. That's where things are going, and Channel GTV is forging ahead for you. That's coming up when your Voice of the Earth continues here on the Wild Side News. Continuing our discussion about the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival that's happening in Nevada City, January 12th through the 14th, Nevada City, California. We're talking with Michael Schoenfeld, who's the Community Outreach Coordinator for Channel G TV. Michael, welcome to the Wild Side News.
Thank you, Sydney. Great to be here.
Michael, first of all, let's talk about what ChannelG.TV is and what your mission is.
We are a nonprofit media company, and we document the work of grassroots nonprofit organizations from around the world that are engaged in environmental, social, and health-related projects. We produce 5-minute films about their work, and we work in 3 ways. We film it ourselves when we can. We assemble the B-roll that a lot of nonprofits have, but it's not put together. And often we cut down professionally done films, and we cut it to 5 minutes. So we're pretty much operating and distributing these films to television, film festivals, on websites, our own website as well, channelg.tv. And in the future, we want to build curriculum for schools, K-12, around these projects. Pretty much want to reach the youth out there. There's so many positive things happening, and most people have no idea.
It's so good to hear you say that there are so many positive things happening, because I think that's really a message that has to get out there. And those of us who are working in the media trying to get the information out about what is happening and what we can do have kind of a challenge, because it sometimes is difficult to fight against all of the stories of disaster and destruction and other things. But it sounds as if you're really putting together quite a spectrum of different messaging. You're providing 9 films at the festival. Why don't you go ahead and give us an overview of what people will see when they come to the film festival from Channel GTV?
You know, we have 9 films, like you said, at this year's Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival. And it's a real honor for us to be included. This is the largest environmental film festival in North America, as far as I can tell.
First of all, what do you think is your most impactful film? There's different messaging that's coming out, but probably there are some that really you feel have an impact.
You know, I'll say there's two. I have to tell you about two that come to mind, because they're happening right now. And a lot of these environmental issues, they're really media issues. If people found out that they were happening, we could win these things. One right, the Sea Shepherd Conservation Society. Paul Watson and his crew are in Antarctica right now, attempting to stop the Japanese whaling fleet, which is operating illegally inside a designated Southern Hemisphere whale sanctuary. They're intending on killing 1,000 whales. They did last year. Greenpeace was there along with Sea Shepherd, and they couldn't stop them. This year, Greenpeace will not be there, and it's only Sea Shepherd. I'd have to say this is one of the most important issues there is, because Japan is violating international marine conservation laws. They're violating the United Nations World Charter on Nature. And there's no enforcement of these rules and regulations, and it's only Sea Shepherd and Paul Watson doing this. And he is also up on the ice in Canada every year trying to stop the baby seals. 300,000 baby seals are killed every year in Canada. He's busy. Next summer he's going to Iceland to stop their proposed whaling program.
How in the world do you cover what Paul Watson does? Because he puts his life on the line, literally.
Yeah,
and his
amazing.
ship was rammed last year. It's quite an amazing story. Do you cover that in 5 minutes?
You know, every single one of our films is an hour-long story, easy. Except we're breaking it down to the length of a music video, the length of the attention span of a lot of young people today.
I appreciate that.
And a long-term goal for Channel G is we want to have a slot on the dial. There's 300-plus stations when you turn on the television or networks, and there is nothing about the environment and certainly nothing about the people who are in cases, taking their lives in their hands to defend animals, defend the earth, defend indigenous people.
Isn't that just frustrating and bizarre? When you think about the importance and the relevance of the environment and nature right now, the fact that there is nothing available. We have the Nature Channel, we have the Discovery Channel, but in terms of this focus, which is literally critical to life, I so much applaud you for that perspective.
For every problem, and there are vast and varied complex problems facing us today, so certainly with the environment, there are people and there are organizations dealing with it. It is amazing. I feel like I have one of the best jobs in the world, because as Channel G's outreach community coordinator, I am constantly meeting and talking with and finding groups and organizations that are doing something, constantly running into passionate, dedicated people who are committed to making this world a better place, and it's really inspiring. So Channel G is set up to strengthen the work of all these activists and nonprofit grassroots organizations, and we've set up the format where we will create these 5-minute films and distribute them to television, internet, and film festivals. And it's true, the media landscape today, it's a tough nut to crack. They're going to crack. I mean, I'm finding that people are hungry for positive information, and people are hungry for knowing how they can help and what they can do. And it's been an incredible journey for us at Channel G. Like I said, we're a nonprofit organization ourselves, and the doors are opening to us and the work that we do in so many ways. And I just want to say, being part of the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival is just an honor for us.
Well, give us a sense of you're presenting 9 different films. Why don't you go ahead and introduce us to more of your offerings there so that people get a sense of really what you're trying to accomplish.
Another really important one is Buffalo Field Campaign. Every time the last remaining wild buffalo herd in Yellowstone National Park crosses the Yellowstone National Park boundary onto public lands, they're being quarantined, captured, and killed by the Montana Department of Livestock. Most people have no idea that this is even taking place, and it's absolutely a crime. It's a Native American issue. This is one of those things that if people found out, this would end tomorrow. And the most dedicated, passionate bunch of volunteers are on it 24/7, 365 days a year. Temperatures right now in Yellowstone, it's minus 20 Fahrenheit, and the Buffalo Field Campaign is up there all the time monitoring the situation, and I've never met a more dedicated bunch of people.
I've spent time in Yellowstone, and you're absolutely right. The plight of the buffalo, while they're in Yellowstone, they actually have a pretty good life. But as soon as, you say, they step over the line there, they become public enemy number one from many different people's perspectives. And unfortunately, it's just really not fair that they don't know where those lines are.
Right. They're basically, the buffalo are following their traditional migratory and summer foraging patterns and routes. And they travel these routes to give birth to their young in the spring. And when the winters get too rough in Yellowstone, they leave the park to find the grasses that they can eat. And the park boundary was not set up for them. All of this killing of the wild buffalo herd is being done for 200 domestic cows. There are so many alternatives. And there is probably 100 million acres of grassland ecosystem awaiting the return of the buffalo. There is no reason to be killing these animals. They can be, you know, transported to somewhere if they needed to be. It's an obscene crime, and the U.S. Forest Service is involved, the U.S. Park Service is involved, the Montana Department of Livestock is the key player. It's really, I'm astounded.
It's a very complex issue because, unfortunately, ranchers who have their livelihood up there have their own fears, but there's really no science to that. There's just it's fear-mongering to a large extent.
Yeah, the main fear is that the bison will give the cows brucellosis. There has never been a single documented case of a wild buffalo transmitting brucellosis to a cow.
Yeah.
So it really is just a fear-based campaign against wild animals in our national park.
It somehow has to do with politics, and that's for another discussion. Let's continue on and talk more about what some of the other presentations are going to be.
Another film is called Surfer's Healing, and that's a fantastic look at a surfing camp for autistic children. Really touching, really valuable. And they are based in California, but they're expanding their programs all around the country and the world. And this just started out from a family whose child was affected with autism, and they saw that the waves and the water and being in the ocean could actually reach him. And it's just great to see this spreading.
Fascinating stuff, yeah.
Another film we have is called Owen Valley, Coming Back to Wildlife. This is a great story and a success story. In 1913, the city of Los Angeles built an aqueduct taking all the eastern Sierra snowmelt to the city 250 miles away. This in turn dried up the Owens River, and it dried up Owens Lake, which was the largest lake in California at one time. 96 some odd years later, the city has been forced to mitigate the dust that's created every time the wind blows out on the dry lake bed. The city of Los Angeles is violating the Clean Air Act 250 miles away from the city.
Fascinating.
So this year, they've been required to control the dust, and they've done so by letting some water flow back into the river, and they've set up a big irrigated system out on the lake bed with pipes and sprinklers, and it's working. It's keeping the dust down. Hundreds of thousands of migratory birds are returning on their annual trek from the southern hemisphere to Alaska and Canada. And the city was not doing this for the birds. They were doing this to keep the dust down and risk being fined $10,000 a day. But in turn, hundreds of thousands of birds are using this habitat, and it's an absolute success story. And the Owens Valley Committee in Lone Pine, California, is pretty much overseeing this whole success, and they are talking with the city to keep this going. The city can do whatever they want to keep the dust down. They could use gravel. They could stop the water flow at any time. Very interesting story and a success. So we're trying. We went up there and filmed, and we're just trying to get the word out of how this is probably the largest restoration project in North America, if not the world.
And yet it's unheard, and people aren't hearing anything about it. Thank you for helping to bring this story forward. That's fascinating.
Thanks.
Let's move forward some more here, and because this is really great stuff. Really great stuff. Yeah.
Thanks. Pachamama Alliance is working in southern Ecuador to organize the indigenous people there. Chevron Texaco has taken $40 billion of oil out of northern Ecuador and left a toxic legacy behind. There's 260 toxic sludge waste pits. There's cancer and leukemia. The people have really suffered. And some of the largest pristine rainforest tracts left on Earth are southern Ecuador. And the Pachamama Alliance is working with the people there to stop what happened in northern Ecuador. And I should just say that 95% of the rainforest oil goes directly to California. And we're just trying to get the word out, let people know what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
What else can I tell you about Planetary Coral Reef Foundation? Their goal is to restore the world's coral reef ecosystems by the year 2020.
They're going to have to hurry up.
I know. Ambitious and visionary, to say the least. But they deserve support. And there's a lot of organizations working. The oceans are in dire straits. I don't see anything in the mainstream media about these kind of things on a large scale. And we want to set up a presence full-time, 24/7, where people can learn, spread awareness, watch films, tell their friends, activate, organize, help.
Well, you know, we're talking with Michael Schoenfeld, who is the Community Outreach Director for Channel GTV, and that's exactly what the Wild Side News is all about. From a radio perspective, we just simply have to hit the mainstream with these messages because they're literally, our lives depend upon it. So I think your vision and mine are very similar. So that is the challenge. The public does want this. They're hungry for it. I know they are. They want the real stories. They want the truth. They want to reconnect with this earth and things that make sense. And yet, for some reason, the media, just for various reasons that we could go on probably for hours about, somehow cuts this out. How can people start to impact and make this change so that they can have access to this type of information? Because that really is what has to happen.
Yeah, I think what our job in the media is to bring it up to the level of easy access for all people. For people who have the ways and means, they can get on the internet and, you know, go to websites, find information. There's a wealth of information of what to do and how to help. But for the mainstream American public and maybe the world at large, it's not that easy. So, you know, we're based in Los Angeles and San Francisco, and for good reason. We're going to crack the media wall and make it attractive for the media companies at large to embrace the future. The future is restoration, and the future is healing this planet and our communities. And no one's an island, so I think as time goes on, everyone is starting to realize that.
There's two ways in which people can really learn more about Channel G. One is going to be to attend the Wild and Scenic Environmental Film Festival. It's happening in Nevada City, California, January 12th through the 14th, in which case they can literally see your work product and these stories, and it's a great opportunity for you to spread your message and unite people who are involved in this. But then for people who want to learn more about Channel G itself, Michael, how should they do that?
You know, our website, www.channelg.tv. You can also watch all of these films on our website.
That's fabulous, and thank you for that. That's really a generous offering to the world.
Thank you. Appreciate your work, too. We're all, so many people, we're all doing the same thing, and it's spreading. And I just want to emphasize that we're focusing on the dedicated, passionate people who are doing this work, and their response has been amazing. We're never going to stop.
Well, Michael Schoenfeld with Channel G TV, I want to thank you so much for your work and as well for adding your voice here on the Wild Side News. I wish we had more time to talk, but that's kind of a wrap on this segment here. So thanks so much, Michael Schoenfeld.
Thanks so much, Wild Side News, and thanks, Sydney.
2007 is the beginning of a new age in nature and environmental awareness. You are making it happen. Thanks. This is Sidney Wildsmith saying adios. Until we meet again next week, or any time on the archives, when your voice of the earth helps create media that matters, here on the Wild Side News.